Welcome to episode 179 of Practical Defense, Pain Compliance. Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I am your host, Alex Haddix. This week, our subject is pain compliance. We're going to take a hard look at what pain compliance means, what it does, and why it doesn't always work. We're also going to review the different methods of employing pain compliance. In other news, I'm going to be a guest on the Martial Arts Lineage podcast the week after next. The Martial Arts Lineage podcast is part of the Martial Arts Lineage Project, which provides a growing database of every martial artist instructor in the world, past and present. It includes a photo, a list of their instructors, students, schools, and styles, and some pertinent information about them. The podcast is an audio documentary to add detail and stories from the martial artists who added life to the tapestry that is our martial arts heritage. It's one thing to read a report or interview. It is quite another to hear it directly in the words from the person. Tim Johnson has taken on a huge project, probably lifelong, and I wish him great success. You can download the Martial Arts Lineage podcast from all the major feed catchers, including iTunes. The website is malineage.com. I'll also include a link in the show notes. And with that, we'll step carefully into the subject of pain compliance. Remember to tap out when it hurts.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro Second Amendment, pro gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
This episode is going to sound really negative, like that I don't like pain compliance techniques. That is not the case. However, just with all tools, practitioners need an understanding of how the tool should be implemented and the limitations. You know, too often, and especially with pain compliance, advocates tout their preferred tool as the best or the ultimate solution and ignore or downplay inherent weaknesses. Pain compliance techniques can be very effective when used under the appropriate conditions. I'm going to spend the most of this episode exposing when pain compliance is inappropriate or when it just won't plain work at all. I feel this is important as during most training, you know, especially during seminars, the focus of the instruction is on when it will work, not when it won't work. I think this can be extremely dangerous because it builds a false confidence in the tool. You know, so here we are. You've spent this money, time, and training, and you think you have a level of protection and skill. Then when you need it most, it might not work, and you're screwed. So what you need in addition to the tool is the understanding of when it won't work, so you can switch to another tool that will be more effective given the specific set of circumstances presented. I'm a huge advocate of multiple tools. There is no such thing as one solution fits all. So what we're going to look at this week are some of the most common types of pain compliance. We're going to talk about joint locks and manipulations, OC spray, even Kubotan, and the taser. But before we can get to the specifics, we need to understand just what we mean by pain compliance. What is the definition of pain compliance? It is most commonly associated with law enforcement techniques to control or direct a person when asking nicely doesn't work. The director inflicts pain upon the subject in a manner that does not permanently damage the subject in order to get him or her to obey a command. As the name suggests, pain to obtain compliance, or pain compliance. The key points to that definition are inducing pain, not permanently damaging. The pain stops when the compliance is obtained. Otherwise, it would be torture. The key to everything is pain. The idea is that the pain is worse than complying with the order given. We do this with everything and everyone. You know, back in my childhood, we were spanked when we did something wrong. If we didn't want the spanking, we didn't perform the forbidden act. We also use spanking on our pets. You know, these days, we have timeouts. You know, laws are a form of pain compliance, a kind of adult version of a timeout. As the saying goes, if you can't do the time, don't commit the crime. The problem is, what if the person you're confronted with doesn't feel pain? Then you could be in serious trouble and you might need to escalate in order to get him to stop. So what could prevent a person from feeling pain? Drugs? Alcohol? Adrenaline? Mental illness? Environmental conditions? And training? Whew, that kind of sounds like a long list, doesn't it? According to the U.S. Department of Justice, half of the people committing crimes do so under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Most law enforcement officers and doctors I've spoken with firmly believe that the statistic is much higher than that. You know, most put the number closer to 90%. Plus, we can guarantee that 100% of the criminals get an adrenaline boost just before or during the act of the crime. Heck, I get an adrenaline boost when I'm the bad guy in simulations. Does that mean pain compliance is useless? Heck no. As in all things, there is a gradient, a scale. There's also a genetic component to pain tolerance. Some people have a low tolerance to pain, and others have a very high threshold. They even say gender can be an issue. Many people believe that women have a higher tolerance to pain than men. There can also be a trained aspect to the pain tolerance. We see this in training in the military applications and high-level athletes. You can be conditioned to push through the pain. So pain tolerance works on a normal bell curve. There can be individuals on either end due to genetics or training, but most fall within the center of the curve. What can skew the curve is the introduction of chemicals to the body, meaning drugs and alcohol. How much the curve is skewed is dependent upon the type of chemical introduced and how that individual reacts to the chemical. There can also be a mental aspect to pain compliance. There's a difference between tolerating pain and just not feeling it. Sometimes the person can be in such an altered mental state that he just doesn't feel the pain at all. This painless state can stem from a mental illness, an injury, or be chemically induced. PCP is commonly related to crimes, dangerous behavior, and not feeling pain. My father-in-law told a story on the show about his experiences with people high on PCP when he was a deputy for the LA County. He told me a bunch of other stories he didn't want recorded. If for some reason the brain has shut off the protective feeling of pain, that person can take a load of punishment and keep going. The downside is that permanent damage and debilitating injury is most often the result. We feel pain for a reason. It's nature's way of telling us to stop before serious injury sets in. Also, just because you don't feel one type of pain doesn't mean you won't feel another. And I'll use my own experience here. I fought in my last tournament back in 2008 at the International Karate Championships. Over the course of the series, I received a sucker punch to the head. I've told this story before, so I won't go into the details. What I want to point out is that it was an instant headache. I was pissed as all heck, and the actual blow didn't hurt, but it shook my coconut and gave me a headache that lasted for hours afterwards. The SOB really clocked me from behind. I was unhindered by it, and I continued the match, and I won in the end. But now here's the point I wanted to make. With all of this going on, I had injured my left leg and didn't know it. I had a huge swelling on my lower leg like someone had put half a grapefruit under the skin. I also had bruising on the top of my foot. My foot was black and blue for 2 weeks after the tournament, and I walked with a limp. My only thought is that I'd been kicking my opponents in the elbow and just wasn't feeling it. So I had sustained these other injuries, but because of my focus and the adrenaline, I didn't feel any of it for about 2 hours. I didn't realize I had the injuries until I was driving home. And then when the adrenaline wore off, I started to feel the pain. So I could feel the gnarly headache, but not the injury to my leg. I could feel one type of pain, but not the other. Now switching subjects a bit, mental illness can also mess with a person's pain tolerance. Your brain interprets how and what you feel. Altering the chemical balance of the brain can have a wide range of effects. This alteration can be achieved through chemicals, both good and bad, and the brain can do it itself by releasing chemicals such as adrenaline. When a person has a mental illness, the brain is different than what is currently considered quote-unquote normal, and I am using air quotes when I say normal. That difference can manifest in the way that the world is perceived through sight, sound, taste, and feel. A person with a mental illness can feel more or less pain than an average person. Sometimes they can even receive signals of pain, but not necessarily recognize it as pain. You know, the variance is huge. These differences can also be from the time of birth, manifest over time, or even be caused by injury. The injury can be physical trauma or trauma caused by drugs. Physically confronting someone with a mental illness can be just as challenging as confronting somebody who's on drugs. The final point before we get into the specifics is that circumstances can also increase pain tolerance. For me, and I think most of the listeners as well, if someone or something is threatening my family, no amount of pain will stop me. Short of loss of limbs or death, I will continue to fight until the threat has been eliminated. I've been taught my entire life that there is no more dangerous an opponent than the man who has nothing left to lose. Sun Tzu also wrote about the circumstances leading to an increased ability to fight. Quote, "Prevent his fighting with the courage of despair. You should not press a desperate foe too hard." End quote. Okay, now on to the specific methods. First up is joint locks and manipulation. These techniques are the most popular with martial artists. We've all seen the master grab someone with a little fingers and effortlessly guide the student around the room as he or she grimaces in pain. Joint locks and manipulation work, and they work well, a good portion of the time. Those who have practiced martial arts with joint manipulation know well that everyone has a different breaking point. That's the whole idea of the tap out. When your training partner feels the pain, he taps and you stop. You perform the technique properly and you took him to the point of feeling pain. Now, if you've trained long enough, you'll eventually come across a partner made of rubber. My primary Hapkido training partner was one of those guys. It was good practice for me because I had to execute the technique perfectly and crank him well beyond the normal range for him to feel it. I doubt you could get him in a good joint lock in a street confrontation when he was really resisting. Me? I'm a complete total wussy when it comes to joint locks. I'm extremely flexible in the direction that my joints are supposed to go. However, when you start cranking my joints in the wrong direction, I am done very quickly. It does not take much to get me to tap out. There are also those who would rather you break them than give in to the pain. I've seen several professional UFC fights where one of the contestants lets his joints be broken or dislocated rather than tap out. So for joint locks to work, the person must feel the pain and then submit rather than have you break them. OC spray is the next category of pain compliance tools. Now, I've covered this a bunch of times in different ways, so I'll just summarize it here. 5% of the people are considered immune to OC spray. It may blind them, but it will not incapacitate them. About 20% of the time, OC spray can make things worse by enraging the subject. If he already has his hands on you or manages to grab you, things just got a whole lot worse. And then, of course, 75% of the time, OC spray drops the target. The pain makes it impossible for them to see, and it makes it hard to breathe, and the fight is just taken out of them. OC spray relies mostly on the burning of the OC to inflict pain. However, if the subject feels no pain, then it's pretty much useless. It may as well be water from a squirt gun. This is why sometimes a chemical irritant is added as a blend in the mix. The irritants affect the nerves directly and can cause a reaction even if the subject feels no pain. So, as discussed in previous episodes, these blended chemical irritants have a long list of their own side effects and limits. Next up, we have the Kubaton. Again, I'm a huge advocate of the Kubaton, and I'm even teaching a seminar at the end of this month. That is Saturday, July 23rd. Signups are available on my website at alexhaddix.com. When you boil the Kubaton down to its essence, it's about crushing skin and nerves and tissue between two hard objects, the Kubaton and bone. This induces a tremendous amount of pain without any causing any real long-term damage. It's incredibly effective under the right set of circumstances, which fortunately are broad, but not limitless. If the person feels no pain, the majority of benefit from the Kubaton is eliminated. It can still be used to reinforce the fist for punching or as a hard object to break bones, especially ribs. The good news is that you need to be near the high end of the pain tolerance threshold in order for the Kubaton not to work. With the proper application, you can usually get some reaction. And this is one of the reasons it's a favorite of law enforcement, and Soke teaches it at the Los Angeles Police Academy. However, nothing is 100%, and the higher the pain tolerance, the less effective it becomes. And finally, we reach the taser. Now, I'm not really certain tasers should be in a category of pain compliance, but many people include them, probably because there's a lack of a better category. Although tasers do cause pain and discomfort, they work by short-circuiting the body's electrical system, breaking the brain's connection to the muscles. When the contact is established, the subject is dropped regardless if he feels pain or not. That's what makes this such an effective tool. There are challenges with a taser, most of them having to do with obtaining a good connection. Clothing can inhibit a connection, or the darts can just bounce off, which will result in multiple shots being fired. And the other challenges with tasers is not so much the tool, but the inappropriate use of the tool. And this is the fault of the user, not the device. Law enforcement has gotten into a lot of trouble over the years for using tasers against non-violent and non-threatening individuals. Now, use of the tasers on passive resistors or even individuals already secured and in custody have led to some serious debate and lawsuits. Tasers are definitely in the less than lethal category, not the non-lethal, because people have died from being tased. Now, generally, these individuals have had pre-existing conditions that were exacerbated by the electrical jolt. However, teasing an old woman in a wheelchair is not appropriate and should not be surprising if it resulted in her death. There are also multiple instances of pregnant women being tased who later miscarried or even had stillbirths. That's just wrong and inappropriate any way you look at it. Departmental policy varies greatly on this, and I won't get into the politics of it. Tasers are a good tool, an effective tool, when used appropriately. The definition of appropriate is what's up for debate. The final thought I'd like to leave you with is that we, as in Palladium Education, do not teach or use pain compliance in a workplace violence prevention program for healthcare facilities. We have a long list of reasons for this, and here are just a few. Now, first, the person is already injured, and because of that injury, he or she may not be in complete control. To then additionally punish that person for a reaction beyond his or her control is wrong. Next, that lack of control can be because of medications prescribed by the facility. If the person is acting out because of a side effect of the drug given by his or her physician, it's not the fault of the person. And again, causing more pain in this instance is wrong. And furthermore, in many instances, pain compliance will not work. Often the person is already on medications that reduce the pain caused by the injury he or she is hospitalized for in the first place. So, for all these reasons and a whole host of other ones, inflicting additional pain upon the person must be avoided. What we teach is appropriate use of body mechanics and leverage to contain the client with the minimal risk of pain or injury to both the person and the staff. We call this compassionate containment, and we hold the trademark on that. So, does pain compliance work? Absolutely. However, we have reviewed many reasons and situations where it might not work. As a practitioner of self-protection, you need to be aware of both the strengths and the weaknesses of any tools you might employ. Most already know the strengths, and now you're a bit more familiar with the weaknesses as well.
When every moment matters and a life is saved, when someone gives blood, when a hand reaches out, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Down the street, across the country, around the world, you help save the day. Every day. Your support truly matters. You can help today. Visit redcross.org.
Welcome back. So, in summary, we have... pain compliance is when the director inflicts pain upon the subject in a manner that does not permanently damage the subject in order to get him or her to obey a command. The premise is that the pain is worse than complying with the order given. Pain compliance techniques can be very effective when used under the appropriate conditions. Drugs, alcohol, adrenaline, mental illness, environmental conditions, and training can increase pain tolerance or even prevent the subject from feeling pain at all. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, half the people of committing crimes do so under the influence of drugs or alcohol. For joint locks to work, the person must first feel the pain and then submit rather than have you break them. OC spray relies mostly on the burning of the OC to inflict pain. However, if the subject feels no pain, then it's pretty much useless. Sometimes companies add irritants to the blend that affects the nerves directly and can cause a reaction even if the subject feels no pain. Coubetons can inflict a tremendous amount of pain. It is incredibly effective in the right set of circumstances, which fortunately are broad, but not limitless. Tasers bypass the pain receptors entirely and work by short-circuiting the body's electrical system, breaking the brain's connection to the muscles. The subject is dropped regardless if he or she feels pain or not. The problem with tasers are establishing the connection and the misuse of the device. So that will do it for this week. You can follow my daily tips on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, I'm Practical Def, and Facebook is Practical Defense. The show now has mobile phone applications for both Android and iOS. You can find a PDF of the show summary and notes in the bonus content section. For those who are local, I am running a Coubetons seminar on Saturday, July 23rd, just a few weeks away, and a knife survival seminar on Saturday, September 24th. Check-in for both of those seminars is at 1:45 p.m. The training will last until about 4. Pre-registration is required, and you can find a link on my website at alexhaddix.com. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe. Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com.